All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Thanks for tuning in. Sometimes I think about how ironical it is that I just do homework for a living. You realize if any of my teachers, kindergarten through 12th grade, had any idea that my job is doing homework, reading and reviewing books and studies and things all day, they wouldn't believe it. They would think that you were a liar if you told them. Anyway, so here I am cramming my homework right before the show, just like always. I do still have that in common with me. Trying to get it all done at the deadline here. I'm about a third of the way through. Reading about the revolving door, the military-industrial complex, and this and that. Great study by Chris Coyne, our friend Chris Coyne, and Tom Duncan. We'll be talking with him today. And you know what? I still got two more breaks, so I'll be a little bit better than halfway done by then, probably, and it'll be fine. I know the material fairly well. All right. And then also, Sina Tusi will be on. She's from, I forget which think tank, a liberal internationalist one, Institute for Policy Studies, I guess. But anyway, they're the guys that run RightWeb, which I'm always praising, or I should praise always, but I always love. It's the best. Oh, man, it's so good. You could spend a whole Saturday just digging through RightWeb.org, I guess it is. Anyway, there's only one. And all the profiles of all the neocons and every horrible thing they ever did, I mean comprehensive biographies of every evil neocon in the world, and all of their think tanks and institutions and who backs them and everything. It's really good. And as I like to point out, it's really just about the neocons and those very closely allied with the neocons and the foreign policy establishment. It is not a profile of every damn right-winger in America, every conservative, every Tea Party person or whatever like that. It's not some broad brush, oil men. No, no, no. It's the think tankers and the Israel lobby, the military-industrial complex, and the, you know the score. RightWeb. They're great. And they got a great write-up of this new guy, Ashton Carter, our new Secretary of Defense, soon to be confirmed. Great little bit of his history for you there. And then also we'll have our old friend Matthew Harwood on the show, as I promised yesterday, to talk about the lone wolf attack. He's now at the ACLU, which is great. And we're talking about the lone wolf threat. Don't you feel threatened? And also, well, we've been talking about the police state consequences of the lone wolf threat, etc., with him. So, yeah. There you go. That's the show today. Coming up, here's starting soon. In a few. Oh, God. These idiots are such idiots. Hey, that's part of being on Twitter. So, anyway, yeah, a lot of news to cover. First of all, there's a claim, unconfirmed, that the presumed last Western hostage being held by the Islamic State, Kayla Jean Mueller, has been killed, and the Islamic State guys are claiming she was killed in an airstrike that the Jordanians or the Americans accidentally killed her themselves. I don't know if that's true or not. I guess it's probably a pretty safe bet she's dead if they say she's dead. But then again, you know, if they'd tortured her to death, they would have bragged about that too, right? So, seems at least possible, plausible, if not likely, I don't know. Hey, pretty bad news there. And, you know, I don't know. That'll be one of my questions for Sina Tusi, is just exactly what is Ashton Carter's position on ground troops in Iraq, reinvasion, really. I mean, there's already 3,000 soldiers there, not including SOCOM and JSOC, CIA, and mercenaries. So, you know, who knows? But are they really dumb enough? Now, I think Obama knows better. But that only counts for a little bit. It's not like he's the one who gets to decide everything. Or, I mean, he sort of kind of does, but only within certain parameters. And you can see how Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who thankfully helped prevent the war with Syria back at the end of summer 2013, he's for this one. He's out to the right of Obama on this, saying, yeah, we need to consider ground troops. So, it could get uglier. But I believe, and not everyone agrees about this, but it seems to me like Matthew Ho is right. Just like, well, I've been saying since last summer. They're trying to bait us into invading. They need a war there. Maybe I'm interpreting this wrong, I don't know, because a politician's a politician, right? But the fact that this guy Baghdadi walks around with a suicide vest on, I think means that he actually believes this stuff and is not so much just in it for himself. In other words, he's in it for the long haul, whether he lives to see the long haul or not. Obviously, he's a human man and he likes being the one in charge and worked real hard to get himself in charge. But at the same time, you know, just because Americans look at things at, you know, 2 weeks at a time at most doesn't mean that that's the way everybody sees things. And there's been a hell of a war over there for a long time. And yeah, there are people who would just as soon like to see the war continue to rage there. And I think even the Islamic State probably have plans and contingencies for melting and turning right back into an insurgency instead of a state, if that's what the situation requires. That's really what they're best at. And so if the Americans do invade, they might just run away and then fight the old style with landmines and sniper bullets. It's a cowardly way to kill if you're an Iraqi killing an American. Everybody knows that. And anyway, I don't know. What do you think's going to happen when Jeb comes? When Hillary Clinton's in charge? I think those two should run together. Anyway, side issue. Could get pretty bad, and I think that's their plan. Just like it was the hoped-for but unexpected gift to bin Laden that Bush invaded Iraq in the first place. They were just trying to get us to invade Afghanistan. You gonna get rid of Saddam for us too? Thanks. That was why. You might have remembered this. You might have noticed at the time in 2003. It was one of the few statements of bin Laden that they actually put out on TV where he urged, or actually maybe this was only in the British papers, I don't know, where he urged the people of Iraq to rise up against the socialist infidel Saddam Hussein and also the Americans when they come too. He wasn't going for that sectarian split. That was more an invention of Zarqawi, I think. But anyway, getting us to fight a long-term war in Afghanistan was bin Laden's plan all along. And Zawahiri, and I know ISIS don't take orders from Zawahiri, but I'm just talking about the strategic logic, may very well be the same. Zawahiri didn't want America to leave Iraq. He wanted America to stay until 300,000 had been killed, he said, until trillions had been spent and the bank was completely broken. So, I don't know. It's funny, man. I kind of got a good feeling about Obama's reluctance to do this. Call him a coward. That's fine with me. His cowardice is serving us well on this one so far. I mean, it's still horrible what he's doing, but it could be so much worse. But I fear it's going to be because, well, the Republicans control both houses of Congress and the War Hawks control the media. So. And there's the whole revolving door, too, you know? Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
I don't know where the hell I had it.
Well, here, it's on antiwar.com. Obama to seek ISIS war request next week. We've already been bombing them since August. But anyway, I'm going to go ahead and, I guess, never mind the phony War Powers Act. Anyway, yeah, go ahead and authorize it just so that they can do whatever they want. And of course, the Democrats have already introduced it in the House. That's right. Yeah, we've seen this before. An authorization to use force against Iraq. This always works out really well. Remember Hillary's excuse? Hey, I didn't vote for war. I just voted to give George Bush the authority to decide whether we should have a war or not. That's totally different.
Yeah.
All right, well. Let's see, what the hell is it? There was one more thing I was going to say about, well, I know I can talk about this, 182 killed across Iraq just yesterday. Margaret Griffiths keeping track at antiwar.com/updates. And I guess I could cynically mention again, the American position that allying with the kings of Jordan and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, all the sultans and emirs of the United Arab Emirates, and I don't know, is Bahrain in on this thing? That allying with these guys, the sultan of self-appointed tyranny, is what gives our campaign Sunni legitimacy? Yeah, America's got all kinds of street cred in Iraq right now. This is what people in D.C. are saying to each other and nodding in agreement. Oh, yeah, I also think that, too, because that means I get to fit in with all the other idiots sitting at this table, too, right? Okay, good. Yeah, that's what we all believe. Legitimacy comes from aligning with the king of Saudi Arabia. Oh, except the Al-Qaeda movement has been based on the primary goal of overthrowing, well, the primary want, not necessarily their, you know, in chronological order first step, but their prime directive has been to overthrow the Saudi royal family from the get-go. From the early 1990s. That's the whole point of attacking us, so that we will bankrupt ourselves in Afghanistan and, oh, wow, neat, Iraq, too. Enough that we won't be able to afford to prop up the Saudis when Al-Qaeda comes for them. That was the whole plan all along. Come on, it's 2015. All they're doing is completely, completely delegitimizing whatever legitimacy is was ever perceived by the people of these countries and their leaders. As just making them the sock puppets of the American butchers, really? And, you know, it's true that Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, I mean, they're nothing but the Republicans and the Democrats of Sunni jihadistan over there. They just butcher people all day long, and people hate their guts for it. You know, when they did the wedding attacks in Jordan, the people of Jordan, that was back in 05, there was attacks in Saudi Arabia in 2004, and they said, yeah, we're trying to start the rebellion in Saudi Arabia, man. We're trying to bring the war down across the border and get this thing going down in Riyadh, but now they killed a bunch of Sunni Muslims in attacks on Western targets. And the people of Saudi Arabia were like, dude, we hate the Americans, but we hate you too. Not mutually exclusive concepts whatsoever. And their public relations work when they're trying to provoke a reaction, you know, an overreaction out of governments. But they're not necessarily that sophisticated when it comes to winning hearts and minds of the rank and file that they're trying to win. You know? I mean, in a sense, and we've talked about this all along, even before ISIS broke off from Nusra, that on this show, that the strategy of crucifying people and beheading people and, you know, mercilessly machine gunning their prisoners, say Syrian army soldiers that they capture and just machine gunning them all and that kind of thing is, God, it's kind of horrible PR. It rallies everyone against them. Hell, we prefer Assad to that. Who wants to get their head cut off? We'll rally around the bot, this fascist dictator, the every other faction says. But on the other hand, it does show, and this is why they do, I really should have said this part first, it shows that, man, we really mean it. Moderates don't fight, extremists do. These guys aren't afraid to die, and they sure as hell ain't afraid to kill, and they are in this war for the long haul, and they're gonna win. This is the winning team, join up. If they'll butcher these men, women, and children like this, just think of the holy hell they'll bring on the real enemy. Assad, the Ba'athist. And so, and of course it also provokes overreactions from the enemies, whether it's the Shiite militias in Iraq, or whether it's the Shiite militias in, aka the Syrian army in Syria, and then the overreactions drive more civilians into supporting them, or at least acquiescing to their rule and that kind of thing for the long term. So, yeah. I'm trying to find an easy way out of this thing, assuming the premises of the American empire over there. I mean, I think the solution is ISIS should be allowed to burn themselves out. Just wait a little bit longer and let the entire Sunni population of Syria and Iraq turn against them and undercut them and pull the rug out from under them. But, that might take a while, and I don't believe that the Americans or the Iranians or the Syrians are going to lay off of them long enough to let that happen anyway, so. I don't know. But I read this hilarious article that's 50% completely dishonest in the Daily Beast about Iran undermining America's position in Iraq, and it brings up all the old myths of Iranian intervention in Iraq against the United States, but completely ignores the fact that America was fighting for Iran all along. Iran only, quote, fought America in Iraq right at the very end, because after it was a contest, when America and Iran worked together to put Dawa and Skiri and the Badr Brigade in power, and Muqtada al-Sadr, part of the United Iraqi Alliance, in power in Baghdad, then the contest was, and who is going to be their patron? And then for the Iranians, it was easy, because George Bush, the idiot, put their guys in power. These were the, other than the Sadrists, these were the Iraqi traitors who had fled to Iran back when Jimmy Carter had Saddam Hussein, his friendly sock puppet, invade Iran in 1980. And so that was a contest America could not possibly win. But then, so they're saying, look, now when we are fighting against ISIS and fighting for the Shiite militias in the Iraqi army, the Shiite Iraqi army in Baghdad, we're really just fighting as a proxy for the Iranians, who are fighting to make sure that they remain predominant in Shiite Iraq and that we remain on the margins. Well, thank God for that. You know, another thing we can thank the Iranians for, helping keep America from reinvading. It's too ugly PR to fight another war on their behalf in that horrible, godforsaken wreck of a former state. Man, I didn't even get to cover Ukraine news, man. I'm sorry. Interviews coming up. Hang tight. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Thomas K. Duncan. He's an assistant professor of economics at Radford University. And he's the co-author of this new study with our friend Chris Coyne from George Mason. It's called The Revolving Door and the Entrenchment of the Permanent War Economy. Welcome to the show, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
I appreciate you joining us today, and I appreciate you taking a very kind of in-depth academic look at this subject, the revolving door, or my favorite phrase, as you guys use it in here as well, the iron triangle. Makes it sound very difficult to break when you put it that way. But let's start with the way that you start the paper. You actually found a quote from I don't know who that's just a great way to say it, I think, about how the military-industrial complex is not a conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy theory, but it's not a conspiracy either. It's just a coalition of interest groups. The same as if we're talking about the AARP or the NRA. Well, they have their backers, too. It's not just old people and gun owners, but there are other people who have a confluence of interests with those prominent lobby groups, whatever one's position on them, right? And so what you're telling me is when it comes to military arms acquisitions, et cetera, that... yeah, it's just the same thing. This is the way business is done in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. That's a quote by Walter Adams, which, you know, he was a fantastic writer on this, too. But, yeah, it's there's nothing particularly different about business in the military except, you know, there's a lot more money involved, and the structure is going to be a little different. But when you talk about it in terms of politics, right, you go into politics, you have your interests, and Congress responds to those interests, the same if you have any other lobby group. Mm-hmm. There just happens to be a whole lot of money in the defense industry for that.
Right. The thing sort is about it is people, I think, reject it because it sounds so cynical. You know, if you're pushing for more benefits for old people or something, well, unless you're a real budget hawk, no harm, no foul, right? But if people are saying, you know, lobbying or have kind of conflicts of interest in profiting off of wars and threats of wars, then that sounds on its face like an immoral kind of thing to do that normal people wouldn't do. And so it sounds like you're making a pretty severe accusation of corruption against people for doing something like that. In fact, I'll give you an example where, and I've been at this for years and years, but the first time I interviewed someone about the hydrogen bomb industrial complex and how much money Honeywell and the rest of them spend lobbying for more H-bombs. Ideally, I think an average American would think that the conflict of interest there is so horrible that it would obviously be not their place to recommend more or less H-bombs, but just to do their patriotic duty and make some if we need some, as to be determined by someone else. But how could it really be where you have lobbyists saying, Senator, you know, we really need this H-bomb money, and that questions like that, H-bombs, submarines, wars, and even policies, that those things could come from sort of the narrow interest of a lobbyist representing a corporation or something like that. It sounds on the face of it like a conspiracy theory, like something that's too cynical for regular people to take part in, no?
Well, it can sound like that, but Chris and I in this paper, and we stress it, you know, we actually state it very plainly. There's nothing illegal about what's going on, right? It really is just business as normal. It does have some negative consequences, right? Like, you know, the title of the paper is The Entrenchment of the Permanent War Economy, which is, you know, what happens when you don't have a true market for defense, right? Who gets to determine how many of those bombs get made or how many tanks get made? Well, it's some guy that's doing the procurement, you know, contracts. And how does he determine what he wants to make? Well, because we don't have a real market system, right, I can't go to the store and buy tanks. And so someone has to make that decision. And so how does that decision get made? Well, what we tend to rely on, at least in the defense sector, is expert advice, right? So you go to the expert and you say, what's the value of this product? Should we make this product? And is it going to be worth the cost? How many lives are going to be saved? Well, what kind of person is going to be able to give you some feedback on that? Well, the military, right? And so who do you go to for expert advice? You go to the military and then you say, hey, would you like this really nice tank that might save your lives? Well, it gets really difficult for the military to say no to things like that. And that sort of starts the system, which is I'm going to ask people that have military contacts or have been in the military or have worked with the military, do you want these military goods? And then you start a relationship. Those people move into Congress, or they move into being lobbyists, or they move into the defense firms, right? And then basically what you're doing over time is solidifying this relationship so that everyone has some military background and has some military interest. And the more that you do that, the more the interests sort of start to coincide with one another, and you get a very military mind, military orient to the people that are making decisions about what kind of spending and what things should be purchased by the military. And it sort of reinforces itself over time in the system. And it's not illegal, but it does have some reinforcing tendencies that means we get more militaristic in our defense sector.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and see, that's the real trick. Not only is it not illegal, the people involved in it don't even know or think that it's wrong. This is just how the system is. And
exactly.
I got a great insight into this mindset years ago by reading a Tom Clancy novel where the whole discussion is, oh, you know who you've got to get to be the Deputy Secretary of Defense, this brilliant genius from General Electric. And, of course, the guy from General Electric does have all of these qualifications, right? That's why he's Mr. Badass over at General Electric. But there's no concept of, you know, any kind of conflict in what his policies are going to be and what his policies will have to do with General Electric in the future. It's simply how business is done. There's no second thought about it. These are the best and brightest people in America. Of course, that's the guy we want to be the Deputy Secretary of Defense. The same way our next interview or two interviews from now is about Ashton Carter. This is why Goldman Sachs wants Ashton Carter. Because he spent so much time in the Pentagon, he must know a lot about what's going on in the world and what they need to do with their investments. So it all just makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Exactly. And, you know, you go back to that not having a market, right? I can't prove these people wrong, and so there's no reason for them to change their mind. And so as long as they say, look, this is valuable, and here's some figures that show you this is valuable, we tend to, on the face value, just accept that, yep, there's value to that. And so then, you know, yeah, they're not, they don't think they're doing anything wrong, but it is reinforcing, and it is, you know, it's the confluence of opinion, right? I mean, I was listening earlier and you talked about, you know, the people sitting around about the Saudi, right? Well, they all nod around the table. Well, the guy who doesn't nod around the table doesn't sit at the table anymore.
Right.
And so the people who get to stay are the people that conform to the mindset of, look, we need to spend more, we need to care about these specific things that I also care about. And then you get more and more spending diverted into military resources, right?
Yep, absolutely. We see it time and time again with the policies and on procurement, just as well as with, what is to be done, say, in Ukraine or in Libya, something like that. But if you look at the F-35, for example, where any independent expert, including some of the people who designed it, will tell you that it's the biggest turkey in the whole wide world. Costs as much as an aircraft carrier, and it's worthless. Basically, the whole fleet of them are outmatched by all the planes that they're replacing. And yet, they just persist. They spent, they say $1.5 trillion, so it must be $3 trillion by now, right?
It's quite a bit. But, I mean, if you think about that system, you know, the guy who's doing the lobbying for the F-35 is never going to walk into the Pentagon and say, yeah, I'm selling you something that's not worth the value. What's he going to say? He's going to say, this is very valuable. Here's how many lives it's going to save, and here's, you know, how it's going to work, and this is why you should fund it. And the guy that doesn't do that doesn't get to be the lobbyist anymore, and he doesn't get to have the job at the defense firm at the end of his term as a lobbyist, and he doesn't get to go back into the Pentagon later, right? Like, if you don't conform to the system, you get left behind from the system.
More with Professor Tom Duncan on the revolving door and the entrenchment of the permanent war economy in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Thomas K. Duncan. He teaches economics at Radford University. He's the co-author of, looks like a couple of papers here with our friend Chris Coyne. the overlooked costs of the permanent war economy. And this one is the revolving door and the entrenchment of the permanent war economy. And let's see. Oh, yeah, where we left off. So, I know what I wanted to get with. You sound like Ludwig von Mises when you're talking about how, well, geez, they don't have a market process for figuring out how much things should cost. It sounds just like Mises describing the Soviet Union under Vladimir Lenin. This is never going to work because the salesman and the customer are the same guy. So nobody knows how much stuff's supposed to cost, and so the best they can do is guess, and they constantly get it wrong. And I just saw the other day the odometer flipped over to $18 trillion worth of national debt now. And I think I'm putting two and two together here, that one has to do with the other. They don't know how much stuff should cost, and it's not their money, too. So instead of, even if you're dealing with a zillion-dollar corporation like IBM or something, and you start wasting a bunch of money as a manager, at some point, someone's going to put you in check. But if you work for the Pentagon, nah, just go ahead and we'll buy a whole desert full of tanks we don't need. No problem. No one will ever stop us till the dollar breaks.
And that's exactly right. And then, you know, Mises is someone that we've relied on to give the market argument, because he does it so clearly, which is, yeah, if you don't have prices, profit, and loss, you can't determine the value. And what is it that the revolving door is set up to do? It's set up to try to find a way to determine value when you don't have a market, which then just relies on expert advice. And that expert advice isn't, you know, it's not interest-free. Right, the people that are giving the advice and the people that are doing the value calculations are people that work in the system. And you don't want to be in a system that doesn't have high value for you. So what do? You say there's really high value. And then once you've done that, we spend more and more money on these programs, right? Like on the F-35 program. What is the value of that jet on the market? Well, we don't really know. We just know what they've told us the value is. And really, they haven't even gotten that right, as the costs keep changing and keep rising on that program. And there is no sanction, really, because they're not suffering any losses. They just ask for more money, and they get more money.
Mm. In fact, back to Carter, the living example, soon-to-be-confirmed new Secretary of Defense here. I was reading his profile this morning, and he's actually known as being kind of a hawk on the F-35. And when he took over as Deputy Secretary of Defense, he told Lockheed why I'm docking you some pay, and I'm going to lengthen the time schedule of testing and all this stuff. So nothing about, you know, a fight to scrap the ridiculous program and just make more F-18s. They're perfectly good, right? but instead, you know, this kind of tinkering around the edges gets him this, reputation as a guy who doesn't take no guff. He's a real expert and willing to stand up to the big dogs like Lockheed, it says. The news is.
And at some level he is standing up to them, but what would have happened to him had he stepped out and said, we're going to be canceling this F-35 program? The question is would he now be considered for, you know, Secretary of Defense? I don't really know the answer to that. I have my suspicions that may not be the case, because there's a lot of money involved in that, and politics, money talks, and that's just how politics is done, right? That's par for the course. There's money talks, and you don't cancel the biggest contract for Lockheed Martin without some kind of consequences on you politically.
Yeah. All right, now, so can you describe to us a little bit more about kind of which corporations, which personalities, which political positions, and what kind of history can you describe about, you know, how this works? Kind of paint a picture for us.
This works on all the defense industries. Northrop Grumman, you know, I mean, Lockheed Martin. If you look at the boards of these places, the people that are higher ups on the boards and on their executive committees, they all have military contacts. They all came out of, you know, they're four-star retired generals and et cetera, right? They recruit these people because they have knowledge of the programs, of the weapons programs, of the needs for the military, right? What does the military say it needs? Well, generals have access to that information, and they retain their contacts through the Pentagon and through the congressional procurement system. And so really, if you look at across the board of any of these groups. They all have someone that has defense, and that makes perfect sense, right? Because you want to work in a defense industry, you should hire some people that have connections to defense. And so again, it's just sort of the natural course of the system. But what happens is, you know, I don't have any price sanctioning, as we talked about, and so, you know, I know I'm General so-and-so that works for Northrop, and I have friends that work at the Pentagon, and I have friends that work in Congress. Well, I'm going to use those connections to get a good lucrative contract for Northrop, right? And I mean that, and so not to single them out, right? This is par for the course for every industry, and so it's a system-wide problem. It's not a firm problem. It's the system. The whole defense sector operates in this manner. And so what we call for is more oversight. And so how do you get more oversight on this problem? Well, if what you're trying to do is say, is this project more valuable, you have to bring in an expert that can tell you whether or not this is more valuable. And all you've done is move the problem up to the next level of the system. So it's a systemic problem that needs to be addressed, which may require more drastic changes into the way that we do procurement and make defense decisions.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems like one real problematic thing in all this, something that seems to me overtly cynical, is when you see the oil companies, but especially the military-industrial complex firms, donating millions of dollars to the, what, dozens now of different little mini Council on Foreign Relations is pushing their own aggressive foreign policy hither, there, and everywhere else. You look at, the Project for a New American Century of the Republicans or the Center for a New American Security of the Democrats. It's all just Lockheed fronts. And all they can ever do is think of things that need doing. You know, never should we, maybe global policing isn't working out for us or anything like that. And it's just as simple as can be. You just look, and it's right on their website. Here's who all gave us money, and it's the guys who are making the bombs.
Absolutely. And so you can say that there's some untoward action about that, but what you can also say is, just imagine if a whole group of people that work in banking finance get together in a room, what are they going to do? They're going to sit around, or they're going to think about problems with the banking system and where do we need to throw money at and where do we need to do that, right? It's the natural course of having these opinions start to sort of coincide with one another, because if you're not in the military mindset, you don't stay long in the military industrial complex. And so the more you get these people around, the more they look around the world and they say, look, here are problems that we can solve. And then they talk with one another. And of course, right? Of course we can solve this. Mm-hmm. You know, we're very smart people, and they are very smart people. And so we're very smart people. And so we know that we have the military. And if we have a little bit more military, we can do more things with it. And everyone agrees with that, right? You get the nodding heads around the table. And the guy that disagrees doesn't stay. And so, you know, it's a natural course that we're going to look for more threats and more things to do. And it just happens that while we're doing that, we also get paid really well. And so you get sort of all of the interest going into let's find additional threats and let's handle additional threats and let's make money doing it.
Right. All right. Now, so just how distorted is the American permanent warfare economy that we've had ever since World War II? I mean, is there a way to illustrate just how big the snapback would be if all of a sudden all these people had to get real jobs?
So that gets pretty complicated. I know that Chris was on your show recently, or you know, earlier a few years ago, talking about the overlooked costs paper that he and I wrote together. And so basically what you're looking at is the counterfactual, which is what would all of those resources otherwise have done? And there's not a great answer to that, as saying, oh, you know, we'd have a whole lot more, you know, car factories or whatever. We might. And so I don't know exactly what that would look like. But we do know that we've been spending pretty excessively in defense since the end of World War II. So, you know, you've got decades of high spending, Cold War spending, now terrorism spending, anti-terrorism spending. Right, all the wars that we did in Afghanistan and Iraq, right? We have all of that spending that could have been used towards more productive things. And what would those have looked like? I don't know, but you have to start imagining that there might be a pretty significant difference from where we would have otherwise been.
Yep. All right. Well said. Thank you very much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
All right, so that's Thomas K. Duncan. He's at Radford University teaching economics there. He's got a couple of papers co-written with our friend Chris Coyne. This one is The Revolving Door and the Entrenchment of the Permanent War Economy. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Same as always. Next up is Matthew Harwood. He's a senior writer and editor for the ACLU and a regular writer for TomDispatch.com, which means we run pretty much everything he writes at antiwar.com as well. You know how it works under Tom Engelhart's name there. The latest is, I think it's on the site today, in fact, The Fear of Lone Wolf Terrorism Rises. Welcome back to the show. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today.
Anytime.
Yeah, good. You're right. The fear of the lone wolf is certainly rising. I think part of it is just because the war on terror has gone on for so long, and it seems like we've gotten off pretty lucky, actually, in terms of retaliation for the amount of violence our government has been dealing out lately. And then especially since the war in Syria, it seems like that's a place where more Westerners have gone than ever went to go, say, fight with the insurgency in the Iraq War or something like that. And so, there's just kind of little ones here or there. You're telling me here not to worry.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to lone wolf terrorism, which what we're basically talking about is a single solitary individual, and it's generally a male, and a lot of times there's mental disturbance. It happens. It's one of those things. It happens. It doesn't happen all that frequently.
Actually, on the definition, let me ask you, does that include, say, Faisal Shahzad, who was working in cooperation with the Pakistani Taliban, who sent him back, but he was on his own at the time? Or you're talking about just goofball in his mom's basement decides that now's the time kind of thing?
Well, generally, the goofballs in the basement are usually caught in some sort of sting. But
yeah, no, that's
Faisal
different.
And usually, if, like, say, Faisal Shahzad, for me, and you know, I'm just a guy at the ACLU, I'm a writer, but when I look at it, I look at the literature, I would say Faisal Shahzad is not a lone wolf because he was trained abroad. And there seems to at least been knowledge that he was supposed to go back and do this. When you look at a more purist definition of it, it really is someone who does it themselves, you know, goes – performs a training himself, or maybe it was in the distant past. So, you know, it could be, say, someone coming back who was in the military, say, or got some sort of training in some other way. But what we're basically talking about here is that there is no command control. There's
like
no one saying,
Canada,
you go out and do
recently,
this.
Right?
Yeah, and then, there's times where you'll see with the literature, too, you want to push back and say, is this person clearly mentally disturbed? That they actually can't even be responsible for their actions. It is just one of these things that it's really hard to figure out what we call lone wolf. And that's kind of one of the points that I wanted to make in the piece is that this has been going on for a long time, but researchers have only really started to focus in on it now. And so the definition itself is still under contention. But for me, it would be always an individual. So the Kouachis and the Paris attack, for me at least, and for many others within the academy, would say they're not lone wolves.
Yeah,
and that's simply just based off that there was two of them. And now we're getting through reporting in the intelligence agencies that these guys were on the radar for a long time, and they do have deep connections to extremist movements overseas.
All right. Now, it has seemed to me that we're pretty lucky that there were, I believe, something like a couple of dozen Somali Americans from the Minneapolis area who went and traveled to Somalia to fight with al-Shabaab against the American-backed government there. And it always seemed to me pretty lucky that none of them decided if they were going to fight in that war that they would just stay here and fight it. soft targets everywhere in Minneapolis, you know, kind of thing. And I don't mean to give anybody bad ideas, but I'm just saying, yeah, if they're motivated enough to go and fight in a jihad in Syria or in Somalia, I don't know. You're saying,
I mean, the only thing I can say is maybe they don't see the United States as the enemy. Especially when it came to al-Shabaab going overseas. I know the fear was of the United States government was going to be that some of these guys are going to come back and attack, but it hasn't happened.
Yeah, maybe they didn't put two and two together as to who was backing the African Union in their occupation of that country or something, but good for us. I mean, don't
get who knows?
I don't want to give them bad ideas, but anyway, so now when you talk about, you know, mostly they're mentally ill, what does exactly that mean? Because, I mean, there's not really a checkbox for saying if somebody's
exactly
willing to kill innocent people, they're some kind of psycho, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're, you know, nuts so out of their minds.
Well, I don't know if you say that. I mean, soldiers kill people all the time. We wouldn't consider them mentally disturbed.
Well, I mean, that's why they make them yell, kill, kill, kill 1,000 times first, you know, but.
Yeah, I'm there's some sort of psychological programming going on there, of course. You know, it's funny when you look at I can only go off the literature. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. It's really not really clearly defined. And again, we're getting into an area that is incredibly fuzzy and gray.
Yeah, you can use the word seems wherever you like here, but you're saying usually these people are more nutty than politically motivated, seemingly.
Well, what's really interesting, too, is, and this has to do with terrorism in general, when you look at people who engage in terrorist acts and join a terrorist group, a lot of us would think that it has everything to do with ideology. But researchers have time and time again found that it is incredibly a complex mixture of why someone joins a terrorist group or engages in terrorism, whether that be a lone actor, which we're talking about, or through, say, the Irish Republican Army or Al-Qaeda. And one of the things that we always get concerned about is you don't want to make a linear line between ideology and violence, because there's tons of people who have what we would consider crazy beliefs or have crazy violent beliefs, but they never lash out violently. So what's always, you know, what the first thing that you'll find in the literature and what we always push back at the ACLU is that there's no profile for these people. You know, so get that out of your head. There's no way, at least yet, where you can say this person has this percentage this amount of likelihood to engage in such and such attack. It's just impossible.
Well, and God help us all when they claim
creatures.
I'm sorry. I was just saying, God help us all when they claim they figured out the algorithm to,
exactly,
to pinpoint who's who and who's to be preventively detained or whatever.
I mean, well, it's funny. It was, you know, when I was doing research for this piece, I found, you know, a piece of literature of researchers basically talking about algorithms for this type of thing. And, of course, the first thing they say, which, you know, any government says or any researcher says, as long as the appropriate civil liberties and privacy constraints are put upon this. But
yeah, well,
how often does that happen?
Yeah, they're talking pre-crime here, so it's kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I mean, we are. You know this. You cover this all the time. We're getting the Minority Report type of stuff all the time now.
Right. Yeah, well, and then so... and then, see, here's the other thing about it, and obviously this is my obsession with it, is you look at the Charlie Hebdo attack, it was terrible and everything, but we're still talking 14 people, I think it was, something right around there, and people are saying, this is just like September 11th, and it's taken as seriously as though it was September 11th, which, you know, gives way too much credit to our enemies in the first place, but it also just goes to show how easy it is to turn people back into that climate of fear. And that their willingness to surrender liberty for security just happens that quick. So, you know, maybe that's the lesson of all these, you know, attacks and kind of half-assed attacks and failed attacks that we've had in America, is that it doesn't take a September 11th. It only takes maybe a nut with a rifle or a half a truck bomb in Times Square or something to really cost us, you know, whatever clauses are left in whichever parts of the First 10 amendments there, you know?
Well, I think what you just said is really interesting, because I think there's a counter narrative to this. There's another lesson we can take from this, and that's what happened in Norway with the Breivik attack. You know, that was, and think of it, you know, it was a coordinated attack performed by one guy. You know, there's a vehicle-borne explosive, explodes in Oslo. I believe it killed somewhere, you know, around 7 or 8 people approximately. And he goes to the island and basically massacres a youth camp. I want to say about 69 people died there. In the end of the day, Norway basically said our response to this is to criminally prosecute Breivik, put him in jail. And at the end of the day, we're not going to change anything about us. We're going to go on. Actually, I believe the prime minister said something along the lines of, you know, our response to this is to be more democratic, to be more open, to love our liberties more. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the type of message you want to send to violent extremists, whether they belong to a group or whether they act out individually. It's like, you're not going to change us. We're stronger than this.
Right. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first. And just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, guys, welcome back. Sorry, I'm no good at watching the clock. Poor Matt. I'm talking with Matt Harwood from the ACLU. Man, you were saying something really great there about how in the aftermath of the Nazi, white supremacist perpetrated massacre in Norway, their reaction was, ain't going to work on us, pal. And then they pulled that off. They did that. It didn't work on them.
Yeah, as far as I know, no new security type of legislation was passed. I'm not even sure any was offered. And so you always have to say, can you imagine if something like that happens here? I mean, you know, generally, one thing we haven't really spoken about yet is that, you know, a lot of times lone wolf attack is a stand-in for Muslim. And that's just not true, especially in the United States. At least since, if we can take pre 9/11, most of the attacks were generally perpetrated by from the right. It was mostly a right wing phenomenon. And then post 9/11, there's the mixture of what would be considered, you know, in the literature, anti-government, also extreme right wing, which is generally anti-Semitic or white supremacist. And then there's the al-Qaeda ideologies. And what's also interesting with that is that generally the al-Qaeda-type ideologies are inflated because what they're finding out is that a lot of them are FBI stings, which run very close to entrapment, if not cross the line into entrapment.
Right. And dozens of those.
One researcher, they found about 15, which accounted for 25% of the so-called lone wolf plots.
Oh, yeah. No, Trevor Aronson's got 50.
But this is, I think, 2001, 2013, and remember, what we're talking about is just lone wolf.
Oh, I see.
That I'm talking about, so not the broader
universe.
Yeah,
a lot of these entrapment
cases. So, like,
Newberg
sting stuff wouldn't even come into this because there's about 3 or 4 guys involved in that.
Right, yeah, I see what you mean. All right.
So, I mean, the latest one probably, we don't know enough yet, but would be the Christopher Cornell thing in Ohio. It's always weird to say that and not think of Soundgarden, but we're not talking about Soundgarden. and that was a gentleman who apparently was going to set off pipe bombs around the Capitol and then kill members of Congress as they fled out the building.
Mm-hmm. I still am fascinated at a government acting like they understand that the purpose of terrorism is to provoke an overreaction, and so the smart play is to not overreact, but to be a grown-up about it for a minute, even when something horrible happens. I mean, again, like you said, this guy, he massacred an entire camp full of kids, 60, 70 kids he killed. And yet, no matter how horrible it was, they refused to exploit it, basically. That's another way to put it. They did not cynically take advantage like the Americans who, as I like to say, might as well have done 9/11 as an inside job because of how cynically they exploited it for every last bit of extra power and extra war that they could get away with taking and launching. And so,
but I would agree. I mean,
but
the
it
one
doesn't,
thing I said,
as
that's
you're
the
saying,
lesson,
it doesn't have
right?
to be that way. It doesn't have to be that.
I mean, it's not even, it doesn't have to. We're not even talking theoretical here. We have an example of it. Like, this is the way you handle these type of things.
Right.
I mean, and even think of Norway. Norway, I mean, you know, their society, he wasn't even, he's not going to jail for the rest of his life. I mean, he was sentenced to, I believe, 21 years, because that's the maximum sentence in Norway. Oh, now, you know, when it comes time where it's near 21 years, they can keep him if they think he's still a threat. And apparently he's trying to form some sort of fascist party in prison. So, you know, maybe they're going to make the designation that he's still a threat.
They might be underreacting a little bit there, don't you think?
Well, I mean, again, it's not that they're just going to open up the prison gates at 21 years. They're going to revisit it, and you know, if there is a continuing security concern, then they can keep him in. Yeah. But what again, it's just another interesting thing: the difference between the United States and other cultures and other countries, especially when we have the problem of mass incarceration and sending people away, you know, almost for the rest of their lives for ridiculous things such as drug crime. So, I mean, again, it's always interesting to do some kind of comparative analysis between, you know, how we act as Americans, or at least our government acts, and then what happens overseas, generally usually in Europe.
Right. Well, you know, back to the algorithms. Can you talk to me a little bit about who's claiming that they can solve this problem? These are the people.
You know what? I don't even have the research in front of me. I didn't even quote in the thing, but I can certainly send it to you if you're interested in it. I don't know if it has any traction. It's just one of those things where, of course, when there's something, it's the normal thing. And again, it's something you probably cover all the time. It's a Homeland Security industrial complex. And, you know, if there's money to be made, there's going to be researchers that are going to stand in to make money for it.
Yeah. Hey, I got a program that can read all of Bin Laden's secret messages in the Al Jazeera broadcast. Pay me. Yeah,
I mean,
no,
I'm in New York now,
I can
but
see
I, you
that.
Know, I
you know where they go? You know what? This guy, the computer has decided that we have probable cause to detain him because of what he might do, and we're how many years away from that? You know?
I mean, who knows? But the only thing I can say is, you know, from the way I use the internet, and I'm sure the way you use the internet, there'd be red flags probably all the time on what we look at and what we surf. And so, and this gets to the point where you have to warn people to really, you know, be vigilant on this type of stuff, is because there's tons of false positives. And again, this comes down to what we were talking about before with profiling. There's no way to profile people who are going to commit political violence. It's not going to happen. It's such, you know, an exceedingly small amount of people do these type of things.
Right.
So there's just really no way of doing it unless you're comfortable with ruining people's lives to do this.
Right. Well, and as you say in the article, too, if you really want to stop somebody who's dangerous in this, that, or the other community, the way to do it is have it where the average people don't consider the police their occupying army, enemy, oppressor, but actually officer friendly on the corner who they might be willing to talk to. Hey, you know, I think Jimmy is getting serious about using that AK on somebody. But people would just as soon not go to the cops or have anything to do with them. And obviously, especially this is a problem in Muslim communities where obviously they have a huge incentive to distance themselves from anyone who might do anything crazy at all and be the first to naturally want to say, hey, we have a problem with this guy. But if the cops are treating them all as enemies, then who wants to have any part of that, you know?
Well, I mean, the one case that I think is the extreme case that I highlight in the piece is Reswar Firdevs, who was clearly mentally I mean, he was literally, by the time of the end of the sting, wearing diapers because he was so far gone. But this was a young gentleman who the FBI entrapped into concocting a plot of flying what they quote-unquote called, you know, drones or unmanned aerial vehicles into the Capitol and the Pentagon. They were, you know, they were basically just small makeshift remote-controlled airplanes. But what's really interesting here, and which completely destroys any trust, you know, the various American Muslim communities can have in law enforcement, is that this was clearly, again, someone who was coming undone. And what should have happened is there should have been an intervention, and the kid should have been given to physicians or some sort of community that could help him out, rather than create this terrorist conspiracy that didn't exist. And again, what was always interesting about this is that they called him a lone wolf, he was not a lone wolf. And one of the things he was charged with was conspiracy to commit terrorism. So once again, I mean, you have the idea that the definition doesn't, you know, that the law enforcement is taking advantage of this definition or this phenomenon.
Right.
Rather than really concerned about making sure that it's defined properly and that we come up with some sort of solutions to it.
Right. They just like saying wolf. That's why.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the things too, even with our article, my article, is that we're trying to tamp down the lone wolf. I mean, the problem is you have to use it if you want people to even understand what you're talking about in the beginning. But as we go through the piece, we start to try to call, you know, solo actors, lone actors, or even just individual terrorists, because it is. I mean, it's used to fearmonger.
Yeah, that was Bush's crowning achievement campaign ad. Or the crowning achievement of his campaign, actually, for re-election in 2004, was that last-ditch, I think, minute-long commercial of a bunch of wolves on a rock about 50 yards away starting to decide to get up and come after you, and only Bush can save you now.
I don't even remember that.
Oh, yeah, no, it was that and a bunch of other things is why he won.
Did Liam Neeson come out and, you know, kill all the wolves?
Yeah, I mean, that's some... Oh, no, you just knew that you could trust Bush to keep you safe as we fade to black. You know, that's how it went. But no, I mean, it's perfect propaganda. And, of course, it means... It implies total randomness that, like, however will the state figure out how to protect us? That's the insurmountable challenge that they must face instead of, you know... This is kind of ridiculous and overblown, and please don't go too far trying to protect me from it, you know?
Yeah. Again, I mean, another point raised in the article is, you know, we have rampage shooters all the time. But we don't want to see the national security state getting involved in trying to stop. I mean, maybe some people do, but, you know, I'm sure, I would hope, a majority of Americans wouldn't, trying to stop violence like this. Because, again, it's unpredictable, it comes out of nowhere, and there's really no way to do it.
And you can create a police state, and then you'll be in danger from it. And so then where are you? Safe and not free and not safe. All right. Thanks, man. I kept you overtime, but I got to let you go. But I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Chad. Anytime.
All right, y'all. That's Matt Harwood. He's at the ACLU and at tomdispatch.com. And this one's under Tom's name at antiwar.com/Englehart. It's The Fear of Lone Wolf Terrorism Rises. And we'll be right back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. Oops, I kind of blew the break there and went into the break recording with Matt Harwood, but you can hear the end of it later at scotthorton.org/interviews if you want. Next up is Sina Tusi, who put together this profile of Ashton Carter, the very soon-to-be-confirmed new Secretary of Defense, replacing Chuck Hagel at the Pentagon. The profile is at RightWeb. And, well, just Google Right Web because the URL is all screwy. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Sina?
Hey, Scott. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Yeah, yeah. So good work on this thing, and much appreciated. I learned a hell of a lot. I guess, can you just start with the basic background of who's this guy? They say he's not a party guy, he's a technocrat. And I don't know if that's supposed to be to his credit or exactly what that means, but he's one of them, right?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Well, I mean, he's definitely more of a... I mean, his background is in academia, so he is kind of more of a technocrat. Like, he has a PhD in theoretical physics from Oxford. He also has a BA in medieval history from Yale. But he does seem generally a little more pragmatic and not as ideological, you know, like super like neocon-y, but he is, you know, he's definitely dedicated to like, you know, maintaining U.S. hegemony across the world. And so he was, you know, President Obama's Deputy Secretary of Defense from August 2011 to December 2013. And in that role, he was in charge of the Pentagon's budget. And he really, he was against sequestration. He wanted to maintain a higher budget. He didn't want any budget cuts. He really kind of, you know, tried to manage his pivot to Asia. He's been more aggressive on China. He's, you know, he's reached out to India and, you know, he negotiated all these arms deals with India as well during his time as Deputy Secretary of Defense. And so, yeah, he's definitely been committed to just, you know, maintaining that kind of just U.S., you know, great power status and, you know, hegemony across the world. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, and then so he was also, you know, before that, he was the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics in the first Obama term from April 2011 to October 2011, or from April 2009 to October 2011. And in this role, he was like the Pentagon's main weapons purchaser. And he was actually referred to as like Wolfie in reference to Paul Wolfowitz, because Paul Wolfowitz, you know, also came from academia and people were kind of worried that he would be similar to Paul Wolfowitz. And, but you know, during that time, he didn't really have, you know, weapons experience or like weapons development or acquisition experience. And he faced criticism for like approving a lot of bad programs and things like that. And, but overall, you know, he's been in the Pentagon for many years, including during the Clinton administration. He was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy, which saw him deal with nuclear arms control issues and like disarming a lot of the former Soviet states and stuff like that. Mm.
So. Hey, let's, when we get to reviewing all this, let's start right there. Back in the Clinton years, that makes me, I don't know, I guess I want to look at a silver lining kind of thing there, that if he, as you say in there, was working with Belarus and Ukraine on their nuclear disarmament, he must have been working in close cooperation with the Russians. He must know somebody in Moscow on a first-name basis, right? Hopefully, but then the one part of the Senate confirmation hearing that I was able to catch the other day, he was saying, oh, yes, I definitely think we should be arming the Ukrainians. Not with nukes, but still in the midst of this crisis with Russia. So I don't know. It seemed like I was hoping maybe familiarity might be, a possible opening for a ratcheting down of tensions here, you know.
It's interesting because I was just reading that. So, yeah, during his time, during the Bill Clinton administration, he actually opposed NATO expansion. Like, he favored this partnership for peace approach with former Secretary of Defense William Perry during the 90s. But, yeah, I mean, as you've been saying, you know, he's been very hawkish during his Senate confirmation hearings this week. He's been saying, you know, we should have, you know, he's inclined to provide defensive arms to Ukraine. He wants to, like, finish the job in Afghanistan and not necessarily, like, you know, remove all U.S. troops. He said he doesn't want to speed up closing Guantanamo either. So, I mean, he's definitely more of a hardliner than Hagel, Chuck Hagel. But, yeah, and he's, you know, even this week, you know, like, John McCain and Joe Lieberman, like, they've been singing his praises and been saying, like, we look forward to having you. And, like, Joe Lieberman said he's bonded personally with Ash Carter, so he's got that going for him as well.
Good times, yeah. Anybody who's nicknamed as Paul Wolfowitz's mini-me, that's got to just be wonderful for all of us. All right, so now I guess, here's something that I didn't see mentioned here, and you may have an update for it at some point, but has he taken a position on ground troops in Iraq and or Syria, because this is a place where Dempsey has felt free apparently to do kind of a McChrystal Petraeus maneuver and try to roll Obama into escalating the war more than the president wants to and has done already.
From stuff I've read, he's actually opposed ground troops in Syria and Iraq, at least as of just before this all happened, before his confirmation hearing, before he was nominated. Actually, last summer, he was on the Charlie Rose show, and he actually said he believes in he thinks there should be a political solution in Syria. And he also said that Iran is actually part of the solution in Iraq and Syria, surprisingly.
So, and he was calling for a negotiated solution in Syria before the fall of Mosul and the declaration of the caliphate a year ago, you say. That's interesting.
This was last summer. I think it was right around the time. I forget exactly if it was before or after the fall of Mosul.
Oh, okay.
He was on the Charlie Rose show around that time.
Even still.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty reasonable for someone who works in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I don't approve of the work with Iran part, but certainly, you know, maybe lay off them a little bit in the middle of this.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Well, and speaking of Iran, you cite two different reports that he wrote, one in 2006, or, you know, signed his name to anyway, one in 06 and one in 08. And I think the one in 08, the more alarming of the two, but they both seem pretty bad as far as the position that he took on Iran and their nuclear program, huh?
Yeah, so yeah, in 08, he basically co-authored a report with the Bipartisan Policy Center, which is this kind of hawkish think tank that, despite its like credentials, is like, you know, this kind of bipartisan, you know, organization that's brought together all these people. It's a very hawkish organization, actually. And so he co-authored this report in 2008 with like basically these neoconservatives like Michael Rubin from American Enterprise Institute and people like Dennis Ross, who's a former Obama advisor on Iran, who's very hawkish as well. And yeah, that report basically, you know, it said like Iran, you know, aims to build nuclear weapons and the U.S. has to bolster its military presence in the Middle East. And it even repeated this kind of debunked idea that, you know, Iran's leaders are like these just kind of irrational extremists. And it said like we can't really contain them with like Cold War deterrence type just mechanisms. Like, so the report basically said Iran can't even have a peaceful enrichment program because of that.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, basically, yeah. I mean, and it called for, you know, just applying more just harsh repercussions on Iran if it doesn't just scale back its nuclear program and just meet the terms that they, you know, bring forth towards Iran and stuff like that. So that was a very just aggressive report.
Yeah. So now, as you note in the profile here, this is in contradiction to the opinion of the intelligence community that they put out in the NIE at the fall of 2007. So, music's playing. So when we get back, I'll ask you, here's a preview of what I'll ask you when we get back. I'll ask you whether this was part of a campaign to contradict that CIA NIE, or is just an honest disagreement, or exactly what role that played politically then, and then more about Ashton Carter with Sina Tusi right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. I'm talking with Sina Tusi from rightweb.irc-online.org. Just Google up rightweb. It'll come right up. And it may have been 15 minutes or 30 since I told you how much I love rightweb. This is such a great project. It's been there for more than a decade now, and it's just the best profiles you could ever hope for on every single one of the neocons. All of the worst think tanks and all of what they're up to and all the institutions and where they get their money. And you should spend your whole freaking weekend trolling through Right Web. It will make you smart. It's awesome. All right. So now that I got that out of the way, I'm talking with Sina Tusi, and we're talking about this latest one, or I don't know how long it's been here, newly updated for sure, Ashton Carter, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense and very soon to be confirmed new Secretary of Defense replacing Chuck Hagel. And so at the break, we were talking, Sina, about the report that he signed on to that came out in 2008 with a bunch of AEI guys and, veterans of the Office of Special Plans and them. And they came together and wrote this thing seemingly in contradiction to the NIE of 2007 saying, oh, yes, indeed, Iran is making nuclear weapons and their nuclear program is a nuclear weapons program. Somehow, I don't know if they just fudged that assertion in there or how exactly they try to prove it in the report. But what I'm really curious about is whether this was part of a concerted effort at the time that was being made to push back on the national intelligence estimate of 07 and try to somehow discredit that as bad intelligence and that actually Team B really knows better and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, there was a lot of backlash against that 2007 NIE. And that NIE was actually, from what I understand, it was kind of a move by the, you know, members of the intelligence community to kind of undermine the Bush administration's effort to, like, go into war with Iran. Like, I know a lot of people from stuff I've read in the Bush administration among these, like, neoconservative and hardliner circles. Like, they were, like, furious with that NIE report. So, yeah, this, you know, the timing of this, you know, Bipartisan Policy Center report, it's very much, you know, we can assume that, you know, it was meant to kind of, you know, challenge that NIE or just say it was untrue or something. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think they were trying to contradict it. But, I mean, you know, that's against the reality of what the situation has been. Like, you know, we've had countless, you know, IAEA reports of Iran's nuclear program. And, you know, it's heavily inspected. And especially in the past year and a half with the Geneva Agreement and the interim nuclear agreement, like, you know, Iran is not developing a nuclear weapon. The program right now is very scaled back. Even during that time, they, you know, various reports, you know, intelligence reports by the United States, even by Israel, you know, they confirmed that Iran had not made the decision to actually build a nuclear bomb. Like, they had a nuclear program, but, you know, they weren't enriching uranium at, you know, levels necessary to build the bomb, like, ever. They've never enriched uranium to 90%, which is what that would be. And yeah, I mean, so these people, they, you know, they were just trying to drum up an excuse for war, you know, like this policy center thing was basically a roadmap to war.
Yeah, that's bad news that he signed on to that. I mean, it's sort of, you know, the best we can hope for, like with the Ukraine answer is, yeah, you got to tell these Republicans what they want to hear for a minute to make your money and move up the chain. But maybe he's a little bit softer in reality. That's about the best we got. But boy, if, you know, even under that interpretation, he's posed as very hawkish. If he wasn't willing to go ahead and concede that the NIE, you know, knew that the all 16 intelligence agencies debunking this spin, were worthy of his challenge or whatever, that he was up to saying that they were wrong. That I don't know. And this is the guy who's replacing Hagel right as they're supposedly negotiating a nuclear deal with the Iranians. So did he say in his hearing how well he supported Obama's effort on that?
You know, I didn't actually see him discuss Iran. I looked it up and stuff. He didn't really explicitly discuss anything related to Iran during his hearing.
Well, they didn't ask him about the nuclear talks, huh?
I mean, it's weird. Yeah, I mean, I looked for it and I didn't see, you know, any specific, like, statements he made regarding just Iran. I think he did just generally, like, Washington Post has this line in their story about his hearing that basically, yeah, I think he wanted to take a more aggressive approach in Ukraine and Iran, possibly. Actually, I'm not sure if I'm reading this right. No, I don't. It doesn't really mention anything about Iran, this story I'm reading. So, yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, he didn't. I'm not sure if they didn't ask him anything or maybe he just didn't give an answer that, you know, these people have chosen to report. Mm-hmm.
You do say in here, though, that he also has written that, you know, war with Iran would be no picnic and we don't really want any part of that. and, you know, more cautious things along those lines, correct?
Yeah, so that's the thing. So in 2009, he basically, you know, co-authored another report that basically he said that, you know, in Iraq, the U.S. attack on Iran would be very, like, counterproductive in terms of just scaling back their nuclear program. Like, you know, Iran would just rebuild it, or they would have to attack, like, you know, repeatedly over time. And he even said, like, an Israeli strike would be, it would have a negative impact for the United States. But so, yeah, he was kind of warned of the consequences of an attack on Iran. But he also, in that report, he still said that, you know, military action must be an integral part of just any strategy aimed at, you know, halting Iran's, like, you know, presumed nuclear bomb program or just nuclear program, you know?
Well, yeah, so it basically sounds like a pretty centrist kind of a guy, really, if that's where the seems. I'm not saying moderate, but
centrist. Yeah, he just doesn't seem super ideological, and he's definitely more of a technocrat. He comes from academia, you know, so he's not like, you know, somebody like Donald Rumsfeld, obviously. But at the same time, I think it seems like he's definitely more hawkish than Chuck Hagel was.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, it remains to be seen how much he can actually do in the, you know, these last year and a half of the Obama administration. I feel like, you know, Obama, like, you know, this is Obama's fourth Secretary of Defense. So at the same time, you know, Obama doesn't want a fifth Secretary of Defense in the next year and a half. So maybe that'll give Carter some more leverage to do stuff he wants to do. But at the same time, it seems like, you know, the Obama White House, they kind of dominate the decision making on foreign policy issues, like, you know, his NSA advisor, Susan Rice, or his chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, like, they really have much more control, it seems like, of foreign policy, or at least they have had in the past 6 years, than, like, the Secretary of Defense. So, I'm not sure how much of a change we'll be seeing in terms of policy and stuff.
By the way, did he take a position in 2011 on regime change in Libya?
You know what? I'm not sure, be honest with you.
All right. Well, that would be interesting to know, too.
That's something we'll definitely look up.
Can you tell us a little bit about his relationship with Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, so he's, you know, he's had a lot of business, you know, ties and stuff, and he was an advisor to Goldman Sachs for a time, and he's basically, you know, he's like a theoretical physicist, so I think he deals more with, like, those technical issues, but yeah. He was an advisor for Goldman Sachs. He worked for the Lincoln Laboratories and Draper Laboratory as well for MIT. And actually last year when he left his position as Deputy Secretary of Defense, like last September, he went on to work for this corporation called the Merkel Foundation. And he was a senior executive director there. And he was working on like just globalization issues and how technology can affect globalization. And I think he advised them on stuff like that. So, I mean, he's got a lot of business ties as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just the military-industrial complex, you know, all these people are tied to all these different just businesses and military groups and stuff.
Yeah, it's that revolving door.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, now, can you tell us a little bit more about his role in pushing the pivot to China thing?
Yeah, so he was definitely, you know, as you know, Obama came in his first term and, you know, announced his pivot to China. Like the U.S. wants to like lower its footprint in the Middle East and just, you know, China's the rising power. We need to go contain them, like maintain our own hegemony in the Pacific area. So, and he led that effort from the Pentagon for the past couple of years. Like he really enhanced U.S. ties with India because that's a key part of the U.S.'s strategy with this pivot to India and pivot to Asia. They really want to, you know, bring India closer to the U.S. sphere of influence and kind of use it to counterbalance and contain China. And so he established all these defense ties with India. They created something called the Defense Trade and Technology Initiative, where they sell weapons to India, military technology. And he even said during his confirmation hearing that China's causing issues in the Pacific and they need to be contained and stuff. So he's definitely going to be more aggressive in the Pacific.
All right. Well, we're all out of time. Thank you very much for your time. I sure appreciate it, Cena.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks a lot.
All right, y'all. That's Cena Tusi. Check out RightWeb. Just Google it. The URL's a mess. See y'all tomorrow. Thanks for listening.